in Matthew chapter 26, what we've been going through, we've got Jesus, and he's been arrested at this point. And as I was introducing this, if you recall, the title of our series, the whole series of Matthew as we've been going, is The Upside Down Kingdom. And I haven't mentioned that in a while, but I think it's worth reminding you of that now. Because when you think of kings, kings are supposed to have power, they're supposed to have dominion, they're supposed to be in authority. And when you imagine a king, you might imagine them on a throne, right? They're up in front of everyone, they're up on a stage, on a throne, looking important. They're kind of demanding the respect and obedience from their subjects, those who are underneath them. Perhaps you imagine them like on a horse riding off into battle, Lord of the Rings style, and they're in charge, they're going off to victory. But you know what you don't imagine is a king tied up, not really by enemy soldiers, but by some preachers, by some religious priests who have taken him captive, taken him under control. And yet that's exactly where we find Jesus tonight. He's been arrested. He has willingly submitted and surrendered himself to the authorities. By the end of our passage today, we're going to see him blindfolded. We'll see him spit on. We will see him being beaten. So what kind of king is this? What kind of king is this? Seems rather unimpressive. Does not seem like a king to follow. Does not seem like a king worthy of devotion, worthy of worship. Well, he's a king unlike any other king, because he's the king of a kingdom unlike any other kingdom. Okay, this is an upside down kingdom. He came to establish a kingdom unlike anything else, anything that we have been familiar with before. And we've seen that by his teaching, we've seen that by his actions, and we'll continue to see that today as he kind of stuns us with the life that he lives out in these 11 verses. So if we start in verse 57, it says, "And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled." So in this verse, we see the start of this trial process that Jesus is going to go through. And if you've read the Gospels, you know that it is kind of a complicated series of events of this legal process that Jesus experiences. And if you pay attention to what's going on, you have to recognize that this is perhaps the most corrupt and illegal legal proceeding that has ever happened throughout history. This is perhaps the most corrupt and illegal proceeding of all time. Now, a lot of criminals claim that. If you ever pay attention, a lot of criminals are like, "Oh, I didn't have a fair trial. Okay, the whole system was rigged against me. The police, the lawyers, the judges, they're not fair. They're being unfair." And almost always, that's because the criminal doesn't like the verdict. Almost always, that's because the criminal is upset that the consequences of their actions has finally caught up with them. So they say, "Well, it's not fair." And it's usually not true. But this time, it actually is true. This is entirely unfair. This is a courtroom, not of truth, but of lies. It's a trial that is going to break the law at pretty much every single step of the way. Here we see Jesus kind of framed. We see him framed by fools. We see him judged by cowards. But remember this, Jesus let it happen. Okay, I started by introducing Jesus there. He's tied up. He's not in power. He's not in control. Well, that's not true. Jesus is in total control. If you remember last week, Jesus said, "If I wanted to, I could have 72,000 angels here in a second. I could take care of this." But no, he lets this happen. And if we're really going to understand what's going on in this, the best thing to do would be to look at all four of the Gospels, and you can kind of piece together what's happening. We don't have time to do that, but if you want to know the timeline and the situation more clearly, you got to look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because each of the Gospels has a little more details, a little more revealed about this court trial that he's going through. And what you find if you do that is he actually has kind of six separate trials. He has three trials before the religious leaders. Okay, there's one before Annas, which we don't even see that in Matthew. And then there's Caiaphas, that's what we see today. And then there's another one kind of before the Sanhedrin, the whole council. Okay, so three before the religious leaders. And then there's going to be three more before the Roman government officials, before the Roman government authorities. And each of them, each and every one of them is full of evil hearts and twisted minds. So here we see that he's taken to Caiaphas, who was the high priest. So we see he's taken to Caiaphas, the high priest. But as I said, this is actually the second trial. Matthew skips over the first one. The first one happened at the house of Annas. Okay? And if you're wondering why that is, a little bit of trivia for you. Well, a lot of the Jews would actually have considered Annas to be the true high priest. They would have looked to him and respected him above Caiaphas, even though Caiaphas was the official high priest. And the reason for that is Annas was the high priest before Caiaphas. And according to Jewish tradition, the position of high priest, that's a position that you have for your whole life. That'd be kind of a lifetime appointment. But the Roman rulers, they didn't like that. They thought that's too much authority, that's too much power, that's too much control given to one man. So we're going to set kind of a term limit. We're going to limit Annas. He only, I think, got to be high priest for like 9 years. And then they replaced him with his son-in-law, Caiaphas. And that's where we see this today. So they started with Annas, but they weren't really able to get done what they needed to get done there. So then they bring him to the house of Caiaphas, to the home of the priests. And if you remember, this is now the middle of the night. It was already getting late in the night before Jesus went to the Garden of Gethsemane, before the disciples fell asleep, before he was arrested, before he's hauled back into the city. So at this point, it's the middle of the night. We're talking sometime between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. You know what doesn't happen between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m.? Trials. Trials. It was actually illegal to hold a trial in the middle of the night. Now, plenty of people get arrested in the middle of the night, but they get arrested and then they get held until the appropriate time to have a trial. But these guys, they didn't do that, because they weren't going to do things the right way, the legal way. They just wanted to deal with Jesus. And if you remember, they wanted to deal with Jesus in a way that the crowds would not be made aware of what was happening. So they forced this to happen in the middle of the night. But the interesting thing is, in their desperation to kill Christ, in their hatred of Jesus, what do they accomplish? They actually move the sovereign divine will of God forward at the exact pace and timeline that God had determined, so that Jesus would be killed exactly when God said he would be killed. So a little thing there for us to notice is that God's going to get his will done. He's going to accomplish his plan, even if those with wicked, evil hearts are opposed to it. He will accomplish what he has set out to do. You can count on that. There's nothing any person could ever do to stop it. But as we go forward with this trial, remember, first of all, it's illegal. It should not have been happening this way. But then in verse 58, we get kind of a detour. It says, but Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. So a little detour from the trial that's occurring, and Matthew lets us know something that's happening with Peter. Okay, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because we're going to deal completely with the betrayal and the denial of Peter next week when we do actually finish chapter 26. But God inspired Matthew to put this verse here for a reason. Okay, so that we could know what is happening to Peter while this is going on. And notice how it starts there. The start of verse 58 is a wonderful thing, but Peter followed him. So if you stop reading there, if you didn't read the whole verse, it's like, great, Peter's back, right? Where we ended last week, all of the disciples fled. Oh, but not Peter. Peter's here. You might have fled, but you're back. You're back to honor your word, that you would remain at the side of your Lord, that you claimed you would never leave. But that's not where the verse ends. No, Peter followed at a distance. He did it at a distance because he didn't want to be too closely associated with Christ, because that would be too costly. That would be too costly. People might see him. They might recognize him. They might expect something from him. They might connect him with Jesus. And then he might have to pay a cost that he wasn't willing to pay. Right? If the crowd knew that he was with Jesus, if they really thought that he followed Christ closely, that he was one of his followers, it might go bad for him. He didn't want that. So therefore, he followed, kind of, sort of, not really. And I think that if you take an honest look at a lot of the world that says that they're following Jesus, this would be a pretty accurate description of the kind of following that most Christians offer Christ. We follow him, we're loosely associated with him, but we're not close. We're not close. Why? Well, because then they can leave whenever they want. Peter, he didn't go all the way in because then he could leave. Because then it wasn't going to cost him. Because then people wouldn't persecute him. That's how people are. They don't want to go all in because then they know there's no escape. So some people, and it just might be one of us, allow the culture and people around us to keep us from following Jesus as closely as we should. Peter used to follow Jesus closely, but not anymore. So how about you? Are you as close to Jesus as you used to be, or has something changed? Did you used to be closer? You used to be tight. You used to feel like you loved him. You used to feel like he loved you. But for some time now, for some reason or another, something's changed. You're worried about what the outside world might think. You're worried how being close to Jesus might actually affect you, how walking in his footsteps, in his plan, according to his will, might have some dangerous, difficult consequences for you. So you just stay a ways away. You're still loosely associated, because then you can still shout to him if you find it convenient. If you think that Jesus or his community might be able to help you, you can kind of holler over to him if it works for you. But you can also run away if it doesn't work for you. A lot of people are that way with Jesus. They go to church on occasion. They read the Bible on occasion if it's convenient. But to go all in and let their life be radically impacted with the interference of Christ, forget it. Forget it. And I tell you that I've been doing this. I've been a pastor now for enough years to recognize that how this usually is seen, when people distance themselves from Christ, they're no longer as close to him as they once were, is almost always seen in their attitude towards the church. Okay, they used to be all in at the church. They loved the church. They were committed to the church. And then they realize, oh, that's kind of painful. Oh, that's asking too much of me. So you know what? I am going to distance myself. But that's all we have. That's all we have for Peter, this one verse, and then we get back to the trial. So that's what's going on with Peter. He's following Jesus, but not really. Just like lots of people, very possibly just like you, remember that. And now we go back to, well, what's Jesus experiencing? What's going on here? Verse 59, now the chief priests, the elders, and all of the council, they sought false testimony against Jesus, put him to death, but they found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last, two false witnesses came forward, and they said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. So what do we see here? First of all, they're looking for false witnesses. Looking for false witnesses. And when I read that, I can't help but wonder, like, how did they go about that? You know, is there like a Facebook page, jobs wanted, false witnesses? We don't care anything about you as long as you're willing to lie. Okay. How do they do this? There's probably wasn't power poles at the time, but probably there wasn't. If you're wondering, the timing of when electricity comes along is much later. But they go put signs up. This is the middle of the night, and they're out there searching for some false witnesses. Maybe a thing that says, if you're willing to turn on Christ, we'll pay you. If you need a reference, just ask Judas. Right? We already paid him 30 pieces of silver. It worked out fine for him. And if you notice, it says false witnesses, false ones. Matthew kind of goes to great length 3 times there, makes it clear this is false, false, false. None of this is true. None of this is right. You know why they needed false ones? Because Jesus was innocent. Because they have an innocent man on trial. If they looked for real ones, they would have found witnesses that hurt their cause. They would have got witnesses that wouldn't have helped them to have Jesus executed, but instead they would have found witnesses that would have testified that Jesus, in fact, was exactly who he said he was. So again, you can kind of imagine the scenario. Wanted witnesses of Jesus. If you're interested, report to the high priest. So then kind of a line forms full of witnesses. And I wonder if they got some. They got some witnesses that didn't support what they were looking for. So I just came up with a few of them. I have no reasoning to how I came up with these ones. But okay, there's this widow, she's in line, and she's standing there, and they say, okay, what's your name? Well, I can't tell you my name because the Bible never reveals my name, but I'm from Nain, and I'll tell you that I had a son, and that guy, Jesus, raised him from the dead. And the priest says, okay, well, you're not really who we're looking for, so thanks for showing up. Here's a piece of silver, but that will do us no good, so move along. Guy comes in, well, my name is Bartimaeus. I once was blind. I couldn't see anything. I knew nothing. But that guy, he made me see. Okay, the priest says, this is going kind of from bad to worse. This isn't working. Move along. Next guy, well, I was paralyzed. I couldn't walk. I had never taken a step in my life. And because of him, I'm walking here today. No, we don't want you either. Perhaps a guy showed up and his name was Legion. Remember him? You know why his name was Legion? Because he was many, meaning he had a lot of demons in him. He was so demonically possessed that he would harm himself and harm anyone who would come near him. And then Jesus came and fixed him and set him free. High priest, we don't want any of that witness of Christ, so we're going to need to find a false one. What were they looking for? Not honest testimony, but false. And that's the reality of a lot of people today. Okay, they don't want the truth of Jesus. They don't want to be told what's actually true. They don't want the truth of Scripture. They just want to be told lies that will allow them to continue on with the plan that they already have. So many people go to church hoping to be told lies that will allow them to continue on with the plan that they have already established. They don't want the truth. They just want to do what they want to do. And that was these guys. Just tell me a lie. Three times over, Matthew says these guys were false. So they're not looking for truth. Instead, they're just looking for whatever they can use to incriminate him. There's another problem with this trial. You know how trials are supposed to work? They're supposed to look for truth. Trials are supposed to start by looking at the evidence, determining was a crime committed. If a crime was committed, okay, now we're going to look at the situation and decide what punishment is warranted. What should we do about it? These guys, they did it backwards. They started with the punishment. They started with, we want to kill Jesus. We want him dead. We want him gone. We can't stand him. He needs to go. Let's try and come up with some crime to accuse him of, okay? We came up with a crime. Well, now let's search his life, find out anyone who's willing to give us some evidence so that we can do what we wanted to do. So they got it backwards. They got it backwards. Way back in John chapter 11, Caiaphas, the same high priest, had already determined that it would be best, that it would be expedient, it would be good for Jesus to die. He already decided Jesus needs to die. Now he's trying to justify it. What's interesting is when he says this in John chapter 11, you know what words he says? It would be good that this one man would die for all of mankind. He's right. He's totally right. He just doesn't understand why. It was good that Jesus died, but not for the reasons that Caiaphas thought. But again, this criminal trial is totally backwards. In the Gospel of Mark, it says the reason why this took so long, where they kept going from witness to witness to witness, is because none of the witnesses' stories aligned. Okay, they would get people together and they couldn't come up with the same lies to tell. So all these people got together, they all hated Jesus, but they didn't agree on anything. That still happens today. People come together, they don't really agree on anything, they just know that they hate Christ, they hate Christ's people. So they couldn't get their story aligned. At that point, the trial should have ended. There's no witnesses. There needed to be on the testimony of two or three witnesses to establish guilt. That's how trials work. They couldn't find them. They searched and searched and searched. Finally, they come up with these two. So this trial should not have happened. There's other reasons why it shouldn't have happened. You know, trials weren't allowed during holidays. They were not allowed to happen during feast days. This was a feast day. Shouldn't have happened. Do you know that even back then, criminals were allowed a sort of defense? They were allowed defense. Jesus didn't get one. Do you know what was supposed to happen to false witnesses? Anyone who was found to bear false witness in a criminal case like this, they were supposed to get the same punishment that they were seeking for the criminal they were testifying against. Meaning all these people that lied about Jesus, they're the ones who should have been killed. That was a law given in Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15. If you're going to bear false witness against someone, if you're lying about them, you say they committed a crime and they didn't commit it, you will then get the same penalty that they would have gotten had they been guilty. So what's interesting is this really isn't so much a courtroom. This should be a courtroom that's happening. Well, first of all, it's not a courtroom. It's Caiaphas' backyard. It's not where criminal proceedings were supposed to happen. But even if it wasn't a courtroom, this isn't a courtroom. This is a crime scene. What's happening? Not a courtroom, but a crime scene. But finally, they do get a couple witnesses together who can get their story straight. Enough that the high priest is giving an accusation that he can use in his argument. And they basically imply that Jesus is a threat to the temple. Right in verse 61 there. This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. Well, there's three problems here with their statement. Number one, Jesus didn't say that. They are distorting, they are twisting the words of Christ. They didn't quote him accurately. What Jesus actually said back in John chapter 2, verses 19 to 20, you can read it, was tear down this temple, and I will rebuild it in 3 days. He doesn't say, I'm going to tear down the temple and rebuild it. He says, if you tear down the temple, then I will rebuild it. Okay, so he doesn't say he's going to destroy the temple. He says, if other people destroy the temple, I'll rebuild it. So they totally misquote him. And just a word of warning for any of you who may find yourself in a position where you are speaking and teaching like Jesus was, eventually people will dig back and they'll try to find things you said and they'll try to twist it, distort it, take it out of context and use it against you. It's been happening for thousands of years. Another problem with this accusation they had is, you know when Jesus had said this? It was over 3 years ago. This happened over 3 years earlier. If they really had a problem with what Jesus said 3 years ago, they should have dealt with it then. Right? They should have dealt with it then. But why didn't they? Because they knew Jesus wasn't talking about destroying the temple. You know how I know that? You know how big the stones were that they used to build the temple? Thousands of kilograms. Jesus had a follower of like 11 guys, right? He had 11 guys with him. They weren't destroying this temple. And if they really thought that's what Jesus meant, they should have let him try. They should have let him try because they didn't believe Jesus had any real power. So they would have proved their point when Jesus failed to do what they were pretending to think Jesus was saying he was going to do. And then the last problem with this accusation is Jesus wasn't even talking about the temple. He was talking about his body, right? He was talking about his body and that it will be raised again in 3 days. But these guys, they seek to reject and discredit Jesus, so they're going to grasp at anything. They're grasping at straws and something that's insignificant, not substantial, hoping to use it against him. And they're going to cling to that because that's all they have. Verse 62, and then the high priest arose. So at this point, Caiaphas is like, this is, you know, I finally got something. This isn't really going that good. I better take over. I better exercise my authority. So then the high priest arises and he says to Jesus, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. So Caiaphas jumps in and Jesus doesn't answer. Caiaphas jumps in. He's like, aren't you going to explain yourself here? Jesus doesn't answer. Now, I think there's probably many reasons why Jesus wouldn't answer. Number one being, these guys had already set their minds on what they were going to do, right? Jesus, no matter how innocent he was not going to convince them to do anything other than to kill him. So that's one reason. But another reason, perhaps the ultimate reason, is he does this to fulfill Old Testament prophecy. Okay, he does this to fulfill the Old Testament prophecy. In Isaiah chapter 53, listen to this. Starting in verse 3, it says, he is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised. We did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our grief, and he carried our sorrows, and yet we esteemed him stricken and smitten by God. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him. By his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone our own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. So you can see this, a clear prophecy of the work that Jesus did. But then, finally, in verse 7 of Isaiah 53, it says, he was oppressed, he was afflicted, and yet he didn't open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. So Jesus didn't answer. Jesus didn't answer. Now, who was it he was talking to? The Bible experts. The Bible experts who should have known Isaiah 53, and you'd think that maybe at this point they would think, wait a minute, we're kind of on the wrong side of the story here. Jesus, by his actions and his whole life, has proven that he is this promised Messiah we're looking for, and we're being a part of fulfilling that prophecy, but we're on the wrong side of this. We're the ones doing the afflicting. We're the ones doing the beating. We're the ones doing the despising. But they were totally blind to the truth, totally blind to the truth. And you can really see this clearly in the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of John chapter 18, you can see that during this kind of confrontation, this so-called trial, if you will, Jesus is struck in the face. We're going to see that as we finish Matthew. So he's hit in the face, and then the officers will yell at him and say, "Is this how you answer the high priest?" They say, is this how you're going to talk to the priest? Is this how you're going to deal with the person in authority? The person who deserves respect? And the irony here is just shocking, because here is Jesus. You know who Jesus is? He is what the Bible calls the great high priest. He is the one who actually deserves honor, who actually deserves respect, who actually has a position of authority. And these corrupt men are pretending to uphold righteousness. They accuse him of disrespecting authority. And they're the ones guilty of doing exactly what they are accusing Christ of doing. They strike the one, they beat the one who holds the office, the position that they are claiming to defend. Okay, the real high priest is standing before them full of truth, full of righteousness, and they can't see it. They can't see it because their hearts are so committed to killing him, because their minds are so twisted, because they have closed their eyes to what is true. So Jesus remains silent, and it says, then the high priest puts him under an oath there in verse 63. Verse 63 puts him under this oath, and this is the kind of oath that actually, according to Scripture, was legally binding. Way back in the book of Leviticus, you see that if someone was going to remain silent after being addressed this way, they would actually be at fault and they would be in danger of being killed. So then Jesus does answer. The high priest is kind of frustrated by the silence of Jesus, kind of goes to a straight, direct question. And, well, Jesus, are you the Messiah or are you not? Right? I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us, are you the Christ, the Son of God? So he's kind of had enough. Just, okay, you've been kind of beating around the bush. You haven't been direct. Just tell me, are you the Messiah? So I'm guessing that at this point, he kind of asked this question with sarcasm. Like, here's Jesus, tied up, not in control, obviously weak. He's like, really? Are you the Son of God? Probably asked this with sarcasm. But Jesus responds in verse 64. Jesus said to him, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. So Jesus says, it is as you have said. Yep, I am. So he was indeed Christ, the Son of God, and he simply testified to that truth. And all of a sudden, everything that has been kind of vaguely talked about, everything that's been kind of veiled, is now declared clearly by Jesus. And in his declaring of this, he very directly quotes from Psalm 110 and Daniel chapter 7. Psalm 110 and Daniel chapter 7 are two passages that are clearly pointing to the coming Messiah. They're clearly pointing to the coming Messiah. And Jesus, when he says, "Yep, I am him, it is as you've said," quotes from them. And then he kind of talks about this power, and it's a little odd. You can't tell exactly what he's describing here. But he says, "Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, coming on the clouds of heaven." It's as if he's saying, you think you're in charge right now? There's going to come a day where I'm going to come in power. Okay, I'm coming down, I'm on a cloud, I'm in charge, you're not in charge. You think you're in charge, you're actually not. The day will come where the roles will be reversed, and I will be doing the judging, not you. So how does this high priest respond? Verse 65, the high priest tears his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think?" They answered and said, "He is deserving of death." So the high priest tears his clothes. If you're familiar with the Bible, you know that when someone would tear their clothes, it was a sign of great emotion. They're very distressed, very emotional. He's acting like he's so offended by what Jesus said. But that's not true. He's just putting on a show, right? This guy's just putting on a show, a false display of emotion, as if he's really concerned with the truth, as if he's really concerned with righteousness. Of course he's not. So they pretend to care about obedience to God, so he rips his clothes. And you know what's interesting? The high priest, by the command of God, wasn't allowed to rip his clothes. This was in direct disobedience to the direction of God. Leviticus chapter 21, verse 10, actually forbids that a high priest should ever tear their clothes for any reason whatsoever. But he's got to put on this kind of pretend show of emotion, pretend care about righteousness. So he tears his clothes, and he says, "Well, do we even need witnesses? What more need of witnesses do we have?" Well, if we're going to do things lawfully, when it came to a crime that would end in execution, someone could not be found guilty by their own testimony alone. So what need of witnesses? Well, if you're going to do things right, you still need witnesses. But again, they don't care about doing anything right. No concern for righteousness. No concern. So here he's pretending to be concerned with righteousness. All the while, he's guilty of committing perhaps the greatest act of unrighteousness in all of human history. Finishing it up in verse 67, then they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palm of their hands, saying, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who was the one who struck you?" Okay, this is Jesus. This is our Lord. This is the one who died for us. When you read this, I think it's natural to, at first, be a bit offended, angry with these guys, that they would hit Jesus this way. They're mocking him. He's being beaten. They're spitting on him. They're saying, "Prophesy." The idea of that is they're saying, "Prophesy. Who's hitting you? You're blindfolded. You don't even know who's hitting you. You're pretending to be the Lord of the universe, and you can't even tell which one of us is punching you in the face." And again, you react to that and think, how could these guys possibly do it? How could they be so evil? Don't be so quick to say that. You know what the Bible says? Apart from Christ, every one of us is an enemy of God. The Bible says that when we were still God's enemy, when we were still fighting against him, that's when Jesus died for you. So don't be too quick to judge these guys and think that you're innocent of the same action. Okay, the Bible says that he died for us while we were still enemies, because apart from the work of Jesus, that's who we are. We're an enemy. We're as guilty as these men who are punching and mocking, beating, spitting. And yet, Jesus put up with it. And yet, Jesus got punched. Yet, Jesus got spit on. got mocked. For you. For you. What kind of king do we have? What kind of king do we have? This just doesn't make sense. Well, that's the kind of king that we have. The kind of king who was arrested without resistance, who submitted and surrendered, who taught things like you're blessed when you're persecuted for righteousness, who said things like you're blessed when you're meek, who said things like you're blessed when you show mercy on those who don't deserve it, you're blessed when you will do whatever it takes to make peace. This isn't weakness here. This is incredible strength. If you had the power that Jesus has at your disposal at this moment, I highly doubt any of us would have had the restraint to prevent us from calling on the angels and killing these guys. But we have a king that's willing to suffer, a king willing to embrace sorrow for us. And it's an appropriate reminder for us here on this Easter. We had a king willing to die. We had a Lord willing to go through what many of us can't imagine. Let's not take it for granted.